Almost looks man-made, Adolin thought idly, considering the shape.
Nearly, Adolin agreed. Can you imagine what an assault would look like if we had 20 or 30 shard-bearers on the battlefield at once? What chance would the Parshendi have?
Yakimov grunted.
Your father and the king are seriously committed to this course, aren't they?
As am I.
I can see what you and your father are doing here, Adolin. But if you keep dueling, you're going to lose your shards. Even you can't always win. Eventually, you'll hit an off day. Then it will all be gone.
I might lose at some point, Adolin agreed. Of course, by then I'll have won half the shards in the kingdom, so I should be able to arrange a replacement.
Yakimov sipped his wine, smiling.
You are a cocky bastard, I'll give you that.
Adolin smiled, then settled down in a squat beside Yakimov's chair. He couldn't sit in one himself, not in shard plate, so he could meet his friend's eyes.
The truth is, Yakimov, I'm not really worried about losing my shards. I'm more worried about finding duels in the first place. I can't seem to get any shard-bearers to agree to a bout, at least not for shards.
There have been certain inducements going around, Yakimov admitted. Promises made to shard-bearers if they refused you.
Sadius. Yakimov inspected his wine. Try Aranev. He's been boasting that he's better than the standings give him credit for. Knowing him, he'll see everyone else refusing and see it as an opportunity for him to do something spectacular. He's pretty good, though.
So am I, Adolin said.
Thanks, Yak. I owe you.
What's this I hear about you being betrothed?
Storms. How had that gotten out?
It's just a causal, Adolin said. And it might not even get that far. The woman's ship seems to have been severely delayed.
2 weeks now, with no word. Even Aunt Navani was getting worried.
Yasna should have sent word.
I never thought you were the type to let yourself be nailed into an arranged marriage, Adolin, Yakimov said. There are lots of winds to ride out there, you know.
Like I said, Adolin replied, it's far from official.
He still didn't know how he felt about all this. Part of him had wanted to push back simply because he resisted being subject to Yasna's manipulation. But then, his recent track record wasn't anything to boast of. After what had happened with Danlin, it wasn't his fault, was it, that he was a friendly man? Why did every woman have to be so jealous? The idea of letting someone else just take care of it all for him was more tempting than he'd ever publicly admit.
I can tell you the details, Adolin said. Maybe at the wine house later tonight?
Bring in Kima. You can tell me how stupid I'm being. Give me some perspective.
Yakimov stared at his wine.
What? Adolin asked. Being seen with you isn't good for one's reputation these days, Adolin, Yakimov said. Your father and the king aren't particularly popular.
It will all blow over.
I'm sure it will, Yakimov said. So let's wait until then, shall we?
Adolin blinked, the words hitting him harder than any blow on the battlefield.
Sure, Adolin forced himself to say. Good man.
Yakimov actually had the audacity to smile at him and lift his cup of wine. Adolin set aside his own cup untouched and stalked off. Sureblood was ready and waiting for him when he reached his men. Adolin moved to swing into the saddle, stewing, but the white Rashadium nudged him with the butt of the head. Adolin sighed, scratching at the horse's ears.
Sorry, he said. Haven't been paying much attention to you lately, have I?
He gave the horse a good scratch and felt somewhat better after climbing into the saddle. Adolin patted Sureblood's neck, and the horse pranced a bit as they started moving. He often did that when Adolin was feeling annoyed, as if trying to improve his master's mood. His four guards for the day followed behind him. They'd obligingly brought their old bridge from Sadius's army to get Adolin's team where they needed to go. They seemed to find it very amusing that Adolin had his soldiers take shifts carrying the thing.
Storming, Yakimov. This has been coming, Adolin admitted to himself. The more you defend, Father, the more they'll pull away.
They were like children. Father really was right. Did Adolin have any true friends? Anyone who would actually stand by him when things were difficult? He knew practically everyone of note in the war camps. Everyone knew him. How many of them actually cared?
I didn't have a fit, Renarin said softly.
Adolin shook out of his brooding. They rode side by side, though Adolin's mount was several hands taller. With Adolin astride a Rashadium, Renarin looked like a child on a pony by comparison, even in his plate. Clouds had rolled across the sun, giving some relief from the glare, though the air had turned cold lately, and it looked like winter was here for a season. The empty plateaus stretched ahead, barren and broken.
I just stood there, Renarin said. I wasn't frozen because of my ailment. I'm just a coward.
You're no coward, Adolin said. I've seen you act as brave as any man. Remember the Chasm Fiend hunt? Renarin shrugged.
You don't know how to fight, Renarin, Adolin said. It's a good thing you froze. You're too new at this to go into battle right now.
I shouldn't be. You started training when you were 6.
That's different.
You're different, you mean?
Renarin said, eyes forward. He wasn't wearing his spectacles. Why was that? Didn't he need them?
Trying to act like he doesn't, Adolin thought.
Renarin so desperately wanted to be useful on a battlefield. He'd resisted all suggestions that he should become an ardent and pursue scholarship, as might have better suited him.
You just need more training, Adolin said. Zyle will whip you into shape. Just give it time. You'll see.
I need to be ready, Renarin said. Something is coming.
The way he said it gave Adolin a shiver. You're talking about the numbers on the walls. Renarin nodded. They'd found another scratched set of them after the recent high storm outside Father's room. 49 days. A new storm comes. According to the guards, nobody had gone in or out. Different men from last time, which made it unlikely it had been one of them.
Storms.
That had been scratched on the wall while Adolin had been sleeping just one room away. Who or what had done it?
Need to be ready, Renarin said, for the coming storm. So little time.
27. Fabrications to distract. 5 years ago. Shallan longed to stay outside. Here in the gardens, people didn't scream at each other. Here there was peace. Unfortunately, it was a fake peace. A piece of carefully planted shale bark and cultivated vines. A fabrication designed to amuse and distract. More and more she longed to escape and visit places where the plants weren't carefully trimmed into shapes, where people didn't step lightly, as if afraid of causing a rock slide, a place away from the shouting. A cool mountain breeze came down from the heights and swept through the gardens, making vines shy backward. She sat away from the flower beds and the sneezing they would bring her, instead studying a section of sturdy shale bark. The Kremlin she sketched turned at the wind, its enormous feelers twitching, before leaning back down to chew on the shale bark. There were so many kinds of Kremlings. Had anyone tried to count them all? By luck, her father had owned a drawing book, one of the works of Dandos the Oilsworn, and she used that for instruction, letting it rest open beside her. A yell sounded from inside the nearby manor house. Shallan's hand stiffened, making an errant streak across her sketch. She took a deep breath and tried to return to her drawing, but another series of shouts put her on edge. She set her pencil down. She was nearly out of sheets from the latest stack her brother had brought her. He returned unpredictably, but never for long, and when he came, he and father avoided one another. Nobody in the manor knew where Helleran went when he left. She lost track of time, staring at a blank sheet of paper. That happened to her sometimes. When she raised her eyes, the sky was darkening. Almost time for father's feast. He had those regularly now. Shallan packed up her things in the satchel, then took off her sun hat and walked toward the manor house. Tall and imposing, the building was an exemplar of the Vaden ideal. Solitary, strong, towering. A work of square blocks and small windows, dappled by dark lichen. Some books called manors like this the soul of Yakaved. Isolated estates, each Brightlord ruling independently. It seemed to her that those writers romanticized rural life. Had they ever actually visited one of the manors, experienced the true dullness of country life in person? Or did they merely fantasize about it from the comfort of their cosmopolitan cities? Inside the house, Shallan turned up the stairs toward her quarters. Father would want her looking nice for the feast. There would be a new dress for her to wear as she sat quietly, not interrupting the discussion. Father had never said so, but she suspected he thought it a pity she had begun speaking again. Perhaps he did not wish her to be able to speak of things she'd seen. She stopped in the hallway, her mind going blank. Shallan? She shook herself to find Van Jushu, her fourth brother, on the steps behind her. How long had she been standing and staring at the wall? The feast would start soon. Jushu's jacket was undone and hung askew. His hair mussed, his cheeks flushed with wine. No cufflinks or belt. They had been fine pieces, each with a glowing gemstone. He'd have gambled those away. "What was Father yelling about earlier?" she asked. "Were you here?"
"No," Jushu said, running his hand through his hair. "But I heard. Balat has been starting fires again, nearly burned down the Storming Servants' building."
Jushu pushed past her, then stumbled, grabbing the banister to keep from falling. Father was not going to like Jushu coming to the feast like this. More yelling.
"Storm's cursed idiot," Jushu said, as Shallan helped him right himself. "Balat is going straight crazy. I'm the only one left in this family with any sense. You were staring at the wall again, weren't you?"
She didn't reply.
"He'll have a new dress for you," Jushu said as she helped him toward his room. "And nothing for me but curses. Bastard. He loved Helleran, and none of us are him, so we don't matter. Helleran is never here. He betrayed Father, almost killed him. And still he's the only one who matters."
They passed Father's chambers. The heavy stump-weight door was open a crack as a maid tidied the room, allowing Shallan to see the far wall. And the glowing strong box. It was hidden behind a painting of a storm at sea that did nothing to dim the powerful white glow. Right through the canvas, she saw the outline of the strong box blazing like a fire. She stumbled, pulling to a stop.
"What are you staring at?"
Jushu demanded, holding to the banister. "The light."
"What light?"
"Behind the painting." He squinted, lurching forward.
"What in the halls are you talking about, girl? It really did ruin your mind, didn't it? Watching him kill Mother?"
Jushu pulled away from her, cursing softly to himself.
"I'm the only one in this family who hasn't gone crazy. The only storming one."
Shallan stared into that light. There hid a monster. There hid Mother's soul. 28. Boots. "The betrayal of Spren has brought us here. They gave their surges to human heirs, but not to those who know them most dear before us," "'Tis no surprise we turned away. Unto the gods we spent our days, and to become their molding clay, they changed us." From the Listener Song of Secrets, 40th stanza.
"The information'll cost you 12 bromes," Shallan said. "Ruby, you see. I'll check each one."
Tin laughed, tossing her head back, jet black hair falling free around her shoulders. She sat in the driver's seat of the wagon, where Bluth used to sit.
"You call that a Bav accent?"
Tin demanded. "I've only ever heard them 3 or 4 times."
"You sounded like you have rocks in your mouth."
"That's how they sound."
"Nah, it's more like they have pebbles in their mouths. But they talk really slow with overemphasized sounds. Like this.
I looked over the paintings that you gave me and they're right nice indeed. Ain't never had a cloth for my backside that was so pleasant."
"You're exaggerating that," Shallan said, though she couldn't help laughing.
"A tad," Tin said, leaning back and sweeping her long, chull-guiding reed in front of her like a shard blade.
"I don't see why knowing a Bav accent would be useful," Shallan said. "They're not a very important people."
"Kid, that's why they're important."
"They're important because they're unimportant," Shallan said. "All right, I know I'm bad at logic sometimes, but something about that statement seems off." Tin smiled. She was so relaxed, so free. Not at all what Shallan had expected after their first encounter. But then the woman had been playing a part. Leader of the guard. This woman Shallan was talking to now, this seemed real.
"Look," Tin said. "If you're going to fool people, you'll need to learn how to act beneath them as well as above them. You're getting the whole important light eyes thing down. I assume you've had good examples."
"You could say that," Shallan replied, thinking of Jasnah.
"Thing is, in a lot of situations, being an important light eyes is useless."
"Being unimportant is important. Being important is useless."
"Got it."
Tin eyed her, chewing on some jerky. Her sword belt hung from a peg on the side of the seat, swaying to the rhythm of the chull's gait.
"You know, kid, you get kind of mouthy when you let your mask down."
Shallan blushed.
"I like it. I prefer people who can laugh at life."
"I can guess what you're trying to teach me," Shallan said. "You're saying that a person with a Bav accent, someone who looks lowly and simple, can go places a light eyes never could.
And can hear or do things a light eyes never could. Accent is important, elocute with distinction, and it often won't matter how little money you have. Wipe your nose on your arm and speak like a Bav, and sometimes people won't even glance to see if you're wearing a sword."
"But my eyes are light blue," Shallan said. "I'll never pass for lowly, no matter what my voice sounds like."
Tin fished in her trouser pocket. She had slung her coat over another peg, and so wore only the pale tan trousers, tight with high boots, and a buttoned shirt. Almost a worker's shirt, though of nicer material. "Here," Tin said, tossing something to her. Shallan barely caught it. She blushed at her clumsiness, then held it up toward the sun. A small vial with some dark liquid inside. "Eye drops," Tin said. "They'll darken your eyes for a few hours."
"Really?"
"Not hard to find if you have the right connections. Useful stuff."
Shallan lowered the vial, suddenly feeling a chill.
"Is there the reverse?" Tin cut in. "Something to turn a dark eyes into a light eyes? Not that I know of. Unless you believe the stories about shard blades."
"Makes sense," Shallan said, relaxing. "You can darken glass by painting it, but I don't think you can lighten it without melting down the whole thing."
"Anyway," Tin said, "you'll need a good backwater accent or two. Herdazian, Bavlander,
something like that. I probably have a rural Vaden accent, Shallan admitted. That won't work out here. Yakaved is a cultured country, and your internal accents are too similar to one another for outsiders to recognize. Alethi won't hear rural from you like a fellow Vaden would. They'll just hear exotic. You've been to a lot of places, haven't you? Shallan asked. I go wherever the winds take me. It's a good life, so long as you're not attached to stuff. Stuff? Shallan asked. But you're... pardon, you're a thief. That's all about getting more stuff. I take what I can get, but that just proves how transient stuff is. You'll take some things, but then you'll lose them. Just like the job I pulled down south. My team never returned from their mission. I'm half convinced they ran off without seeing me paid. She shrugged. It happens. No need to get worked up. What kind of job was it? Shallan asked, blinking pointedly to take a memory of Tin lounging there, sweeping her reed as if conducting musicians, not a care in the world. They'd nearly died a couple of weeks back, but Tin took it in stride. It was a big job, Tin said. Important for the kinds of people who make things change in the world. I still haven't heard back from the ones who hired us. Maybe my men didn't run off. Maybe they just failed. I don't know for certain. Here Shallan caught tension in Tin's face, a tightening of the skin around the eyes, a distance to her gaze. She was worried about what her employers might do to her. Then it was gone, smoothed away. Have a look, Tin said, nodding up ahead. Shallan followed the gesture and noticed moving figures a few hills over. The landscape had slowly changed as they approached the plains. The hills grew steeper, but the air a little warmer, and plant life was more prevalent. Stands of trees clustered in some of the valleys, where waters would flow after high storms. The trees were squat, different from the flowing majesty of the ones she'd known in Yakaved, but it was still nice to see something other than scrub. The grass here was fuller. It pulled smartly away from the wagons, sinking into its burrows. The rock buds here grew large, and shale bark cropped up in patches, often with lifespren bouncing about like tiny green motes. During their day's traveling, they'd passed other caravans, more plentiful now that they were closer to the shattered plains. So Shallan wasn't surprised to see someone up ahead. The figures, however, rode horses. Who could afford animals like that? And why didn't they have an escort? There seemed to be only four of them. The caravan rolled to a stop as Makob yelled an order from the first wagon. Shallan had learned through awful experience just how dangerous any encounter out here could be. None were taken lightly by caravan masters. She was the authority here, but she allowed those with more experience to call stops and choose their path. Come on, Tin said, stopping the chul with a whack of the stick, then hopping down from the wagon and grabbing her coat and sword off their pegs. Shallan scrambled down, putting on her Yasna face. She let herself be herself with Tin. With the others, she needed to be a leader. Stiff, stern, but hopefully inspiring. To that end, she was pleased with the blue dress that Makob had given her. Embroidered with silver, made of the finest silk, it was a wonderful upgrade from her tattered one. They walked past where Vatha and his men marched just behind the lead wagon. The leader of the deserters shot Tin a glare. His dislike of the woman was only more reason to respect her, despite her criminal proclivities. Brightness Devar and I will handle this, Tin said to Makob as they passed. Brightness? Makob said, standing and looking toward Shallan. What if they are bandits? There are only four of them, Master Makob, Shallan said lightly. The day I can't handle four bandits on my own is a day I deserve to be robbed. They passed the wagon, Tin tying on her belt. What if they are bandits? Shallan hissed, once they were out of earshot.
I thought you said you could handle four.
I was just going along with your attitude.
That's dangerous, kid,
Tin said with a grin.
Look, bandits wouldn't let us see them, and they certainly wouldn't just sit there.
The group of four men waited on the top of the hill. As Shallan drew closer, she could see that they were wearing crisp blue uniforms that looked quite genuine. At the bottom of the ravine between hills, Shallan stubbed her toe on a rock bud. She grimaced. Makeup had given her light-eyed shoes to match her dress. They were luxurious and probably worth a fortune, but they were little more than slippers. "We'll wait here," Shallan said. "They can come to us."
"Sounds good to me," Tin said.
Indeed, up above, the men started moving down the hillside when they noticed Shallan and Tin were waiting for them. Two more came and followed after them on foot, men not in uniforms but workers' clothing.
"Grooms?"
"Who are you going to be?" Tin asked softly.
"Myself?" Shallan replied. "What's the fun in that?" Tin said. "How's your horn eater?"
"Horn eater? I..."
"Too late," Tin said as the men rode up.
Shallan found horses intimidating. The large, brutish things weren't docile like Chulls. Horses were always stomping about, snorting. The lead rider reined in his horse with some obvious annoyance. He didn't seem in complete control of the beast.
"Brightness," he said,
nodding to her as he saw her eyes. Shockingly, he was dark-eyed, a tall man with black alethi hair he wore down to his shoulders. He looked over Tin, noting the sword and the soldier's uniform, but let slip no reaction. A hard man, this one.
"Her Highness,"
Tin announced in a loud voice, gesturing toward Shallan.
"Princess Unulukuak, Kina Autuatai. You are in the presence of royalty, Dark Eyes."
"A horn eater,"
the man said, leaning down, inspecting Shallan's red hair.
"Wearing a Vorin dress. Rock would have a fit."
Tin looked to Shallan and raised an eyebrow.
"I'm going to strangle you, woman," Shallan thought, then took a deep breath.
"This thing,"
Shallan said, gesturing at her dress.
"He is not what you have a princess wear. He is good for me. You will be respect."
Fortunately, her red face would fit for a horn eater. They were a passionate people. Tin nodded to her, looking appreciative.
"I'm sorry," the man said, though he didn't seem very apologetic.
What was a Dark Eyes doing riding an animal of such value? One of the man's companions was inspecting the caravan through a spyglass. He was dark-eyed, too, but looked more comfortable on his mount.
"Seven wagons, Cal," the man said. "Well guarded."
The man, Cal, nodded.
"I've been sent out to look for signs of bandits," he said to Tin. "Has all been well with your caravan?"
"We ran into some bandits 3 weeks ago,"
Tin said, thumbing over her shoulder.
"Why do you care?"
"We represent the king," the man said, "and are from the personal guard of Dalinar Kolin."
Oh, storms. Well, that was going to be inconvenient.
"Bright Lord Kolin," Cal continued, "is investigating the possibility of a wider range of control around the Shattered Plains. If you really were attacked, I would like to know the details."
"If we were attacked?" Shallan asked. "You doubt our word?"
"No, I am offended,"
Shallan declared, folding her arms.
"You'd better watch yourself," Tin told the men. "Her Highness does not like to be offended."
"How surprising," Cal said.
"Where did the attack take place? You fought it off? How many bandits were there?"
Tin filled him in on the details, which gave Shallan a chance to think. Dalinar Kolin was her future father-in-law, if the causal matured into a marriage. Hopefully she wouldn't run into these particular soldiers again.
I really am going to strangle you, Tin.
Their leader listened to the details of the attack with a stoic air. He didn't seem like a very pleasant man.
I am sorry to hear of your losses, Cal said. But you're only a day and a half by caravan from the shattered plains now. You should be safe the rest of the way.
I am curiosity, Shallan said. These animals, they are horses, yet you are dark-eyed. This Colin trusts you well.
I do my duty, Cal said, studying her.
Where are the rest of your people?
That caravan looks as if it's all Vorin. Also, you look a little spindly for a horn-eater.
Did you just insult the princess's weight?
Tin asked, aghast. Storms, she was good. She actually managed to produce anger spren with the remark. Well, nothing to do but soldier on.
I am offend, Shallan yelled. You have offended her highness again. Very offend. You'd better apologize. No apologize, Shallan declared. Boots.
Cal leaned back, looking between the two of them, trying to parse what had just been said.
Boots? He asked.
Yes, Shallan said. I'm liking your boots. You will apology with boots.
You want my boots?
Did you not hear her highness?
Tin asked, arms folded.
Are soldiers of this Dalinar Kolin's army so disrespectful?
I'm not disrespectful, Cal said. But I'm not giving her my boots.
You insult,
Shallan declared, stepping forward, pointing at him. Storm, father, those horses were enormous.
I will tell all who are to listen. When arriving, I will say, Colin is stealer of boots and taker of women's virtue.
Cal sputtered.
Virtue?
Yes,
Shallan said. Then she glanced over to Tin.
Virtue? No, wrong word.
Virtue. No, vesture.
Vesture! Taker of woman's vesture! That is word I wanted.
The soldier glanced to his companions, looking confused. Drat, Shallan thought. Good puns are lost on men with poor vocabulary.
Is no matter, Shallan said, throwing up her hand. All will know what you have done in wronging me. You have laid me bare, here in this wilderness. Stripping me is an insult to my house and my clan. All will know that Colin...
Oh, stop, stop, Cal said,
reaching down and awkwardly pulling his boot from his foot while on horseback. His sock had a hole in the heel.
Storming woman, he muttered.
He tossed the first boot down to her, then removed the other.
Your apology is accepted,
Tin said, fetching the boots.
By damnation it had better be,
Cal said.
I'll pass along your story. Maybe we can get this storming place patrolled. Come on, men.
He turned and left them without another word, perhaps fearing another horn-eater diatribe. Once they were out of earshot, Shallan looked at the boots, then started laughing uncontrollably. Joy spren rose around her, like blue leaves that started at her feet, then moved up in a swirl before flaring out above her as if in a blast of wind. Shallan watched them with a big smile. Those were very rare.
Ah, Tin said with a smile. No use denying. That was fun.
I'm still going to strangle you, Shallan said. He knew we were playing with him.
That has to be the worst horn-eater impression a woman has ever done.
It was actually pretty good, Tin said. You overdid the words, but the accent itself was spot on.
That wasn't the point, though. She handed back the boots.
What was the point? Shallan asked, as they hiked back toward the caravan.
Making a fool out of me?
Partially, Tin said.
That was sarcasm.
If you're going to learn to do this, Tin said, you have to be comfortable in situations like that. You can't be embarrassed when you pose as someone else. The more outrageous the attempt, the straighter you have to play it.
The only way to get better is to practice, and in front of people who very well might catch you.
I suppose, Shallan said.
Those boots are too big for you, Tin noted, though I did love the look on his face when you asked for them.
No apologize. Boots.
I really need some boots, Shallan said. I'm tired of walking around on rock barefoot or in slippers. A little padding and these will fit.
She held them up.
They were rather large.
Maybe.
She looked backward.
I hope he'll be all right without them. What if he has to fight bandits on his way back?
Tin rolled her eyes.
We're going to have to talk about that kind-heartedness of yours sometime, kid.
It's not a bad thing to be nice.
You're training to be a con artist, Tin said. For now, let's get back to the caravan. I want to talk you through the finer points of a horn-eater accent. With that red hair of yours, you'll probably find more chances to use it than you would others.
29. Rule of Blood. Art form for colors beyond our ken. For its grand songs we yearn. We must attract creation's spren. These songs suffice till we learn. From the Listener Song of Revision, 279th stanza. Toral Sadius closed his eyes and rested Oathbringer on his shoulder, breathing in the sweet, moldy scent of Parshendi blood. The thrill of battle surged within him, a blessed and beautiful strength. His own blood pumped so loudly in his ears he almost couldn't hear the battlefield shouts and groans of pain. For a moment he reveled only in the delicious glow of the thrill, the heady euphoria at having spent an hour engaged in the only thing that brought true joy anymore, contending for his life and taking those of enemies lesser than himself. It faded. As always, the thrill was fleeting once battle itself ended. It had grown less and less sweet during these raids on the Parshendi, likely because he knew deep inside that this contest was pointless. It did not stretch him, did not carry him further toward his ultimate goals of conquest. Slaughtering creme-covered savages in a herald's forsaken land had truly lost its savor. He sighed, lowering his blade, opening his eyes. Amaram approached across the battlefield, stepping over corpses of men and Parshendi. His shard plate was bloodied purple up to the elbows, and he carried a glimmering gem heart in one gauntleted hand. He kicked aside a Parshendi corpse and joined Sadius, his own honor guard fanning out to join those of his high prince. Sadius spared a moment of annoyance for how efficiently they moved, particularly when compared to his own men. Amaram pulled off his helm and hefted the gem heart, tossing it up and catching it.
Your maneuver here today failed, you realize.
Failed, Sadius said, lifting his faceplate. Nearby, his soldiers slaughtered a pocket of 50 Parshendi who hadn't managed to get off the plateau when the rest retreated.
I think this went quite nicely,
Amaram pointed. A stain had appeared in the plateaus to the west, toward the war camps. The banners indicated that Hatham and Roian, the two high princes who were supposed to have gone on this plateau run, had arrived together. They used bridges like Dalinar's, slow plodding things that had been easy to outrun. One of the advantages of the bridge crews Sadius preferred was that they needed very little training to function. If Dalinar had thought to slow him down with his stunt of trading Oathbringer for Sadius's bridgeman, he had been proven a fool.
We needed to get out here, Amaram said, seize the gem heart and return before the others arrived. Then you could have claimed that you didn't realize you weren't in the rotation today. The arrival of both other armies removes that shred of deniability.
You mistake me, Sadius said. You assume I still care about deniability.
The last Parshendi died with enraged screams. Sadius felt proud of that. Others said Parshendi warriors on the field never surrendered, but he'd seen them try it once, long ago, in the first year of the war. They'd laid down their weapons.
He'd slaughtered them all personally, with shard hammer and plate, beneath the eyes of their retreating companions watching from a nearby plateau. Never again had any Parshendi denied him or his men their right to finish a battle the proper way. Sadius waved for the vanguard to gather and escort him back to the war camps, while the rest of the army licked its wounds. Amaram joined him, crossing a bridge and passing idling bridgemen who lay on the ground and slept while better men died.
"I am duty-bound to join you on the battlefield, Your Highness," Amaram said as they walked. "But I want you to know that I do not approve of our actions here. We should be seeking to bridge our differences with the King and Delinar, not trying to agitate them further."
Sadius snorted.
"Don't give me that noble talk. It works fine for others, but I know you for the ruthless bastard you really are."
Amaram set his jaw, eyes forward. When they reached their horses, he reached out, hand on Sadius's arm.
"Toril," he said softly, "there is so much more to the world than your squabbles. You're right about me, of course. Take that admission with the understanding that to you, above all others, I can speak the truth. Alethkar needs to be strong for what is coming."
Sadius climbed the mounting block the groom had set out. Getting onto a horse in shardplate could be dangerous to the animal if not done correctly. Besides, he'd once had a stirrup snap on him when he stepped into it to haul himself into the saddle. He'd ended up on his backside.
"Alethkar does need to be strong," Sadius said, holding out a gauntleted hand. "So I'll make it so by force of fist and the rule of blood."
Amaram reluctantly placed the gem heart there, and Sadius gripped it, holding his reins in the other hand.
"Do you ever worry," Amaram asked, "about what you do, about what we must do?"
He nodded toward a group of surgeons carrying wounded men across the bridges.
"Worry?" Sadius said. "Why should I? It gives the wretches a chance to die in battle for something worthwhile."
"You say things like that a lot these days, I've noticed," Amaram said. "You weren't like that before."
"I've learned to accept the world as it is, Amaram," Sadius said, turning his horse. "That's something very few people are willing to do. They stumble along, hoping, dreaming, pretending. That doesn't change a single storming thing in life. You have to stare the world in the eyes, in all its grimy brutality. You have to acknowledge its depravities, live with them. It's the only way to accomplish anything meaningful."
With a squeeze of the knees, Sadius started his horse forward, leaving Amaram behind for the moment. The man would remain loyal. Sadius and Amaram had an understanding. Even Amaram now being a shard-bearer would not change that. As Sadius and his vanguard approached Hatham's army, he noticed a group of Parshendi on a nearby plateau watching. Those scouts of theirs were getting bold. He sent a team of archers to go chase them off, then rode toward a figure in resplendent shardplate at the front of Hatham's army, the High Prince himself, seated upon a reshadium.
Damnation! Those animals were far superior to any other horse flesh. How to get one?
"Sadius," Hatham called out to him. "What have you done here?"
After a quick moment of decision, Sadius lifted his arm back and hurled the gem heart across the plateau, separating them. It hit the rock near Hatham and bounced along in a roll, glowing faintly.
"I got bored," Sadius shouted back. "I thought I'd save you some trouble."
Then, ignoring further questions, Sadius continued on his way. Adolin Colin had a duel today, and he'd decided not to miss it, just in case the youth embarrassed himself again. A few hours later, Sadius settled down into his place in the dueling arena, tugging at the stock on his neck. Insufferable things. Fashionable, but insufferable. He would never tell a soul, not even ELA, that he secretly wished he could just go about in a simple uniform like Dalinar. He couldn't ever do that, of course, not just because he wouldn't be seen bowing to the codes and the king's authority, but because a military uniform was actually the wrong uniform for these days. The battles they fought for Alethkar at the moment weren't battles with sword and shield. It was important to dress the part when you had a role to play. Dalinar's military outfits proved he was lost, that he didn't understand the game he was playing. Sadeus leaned back to wait as whispers filled the arena like water in a bowl. A large attendance today. Adolin's stunt in his previous duel had drawn attention, and anything novel was of interest to the court. Sadeus's seat had a space cleared around it to give him extra room and privacy, though it was really just a simple chair built onto the stone bleachers of this pit of an arena. He hated how his body felt outside of Shardplate, and he hated more how he looked. Once he'd turned heads as he walked. His power had filled a room. Everyone had looked to him, and many had lusted when seeing him. Lusted for his power, for who he was. He was losing that. Oh, he was still powerful, perhaps more so. But the look in their eyes was different, and every way of responding to his loss of youthfulness made him look petulant. He was dying, step by step. Like every man, true, but he felt that death looming. Decades away, hopefully, but it cast a long, long shadow. The only path to immortality was through conquest. Rustling clothing announced ELA slipping into the seat beside his. Sadeus reached out absently, resting his hand on the small of her back and scratching at that place she liked. Her name was symmetrical, a tiny bit of blasphemy from her parents. Some people dared imply such holiness of their children. Sadeus liked those types. Indeed, the name was what had first intrigued him about her. His wife said with a sigh. Very nice. The duel hasn't started yet, I see. Mere moments away, I believe. Good. I can't stand waiting. I hear you gave away the gem heart you captured today. Threw it at Hatham's feet and rode away as if I didn't have a care. Clever. I should have seen that as an option. You'll undermine Dalinar's claim that we only resist him because of our greed. Below, Adolin finally stepped out onto the field wearing his blue shard plate. Some of the light eyes clapped politely. Across the way, Eraniv left his own preparatory room, his polished plate its natural color except across the breastplate, which he'd painted a deep black. Sadeus narrowed his eyes, still scratching Ile's back. This duel should not even be happening, he said. Everyone was supposed to be too afraid or too dismissive to accept his challenges. Idiots, Ile said softly. They know, Torol, what they're supposed to do. I've dropped the right hints and promises. And yet every one of them secretly wants to be the man who brings down Adolin. Duelists are not a particularly dependable lot. They are brash, hot-headed, and care too much about showing off and gaining renown. His father's plan cannot be allowed to work, Sadeus said. It won't. Sadeus glanced at where Dalinar had set up. Sadeus's own position was not too far away, within shouting distance. Dalinar didn't look at him. I built this kingdom, Sadeus said softly. I know how fragile it is, Ile. It should not be so difficult to knock the thing down. That would be the only way to properly build it anew. Like reforging a weapon, you melted down the remnants of the old before you created the replacement. The duel began down below, Adolin striding across the sands toward Eraniv, who wielded old Gavilar's blade with its wicked design. Adolin engaged too quickly. Was the boy that eager? In the crowd, light eyes grew quiet and dark eyes shouted, eager for another display like last time. However, this didn't devolve into a wrestling match. The two exchanged testing blows, and Adolin backed away, having taken a hit on his shoulder. Sloppy, Sadius thought. I finally discovered the nature of that disturbance at the king's chambers 2 weeks ago, ELA noted. Sadius smiled, eyes still on the bout. Of course you did. Assassination attempt, she said. Someone sabotaged the king's balcony in a crude attempt at dropping him 100 feet to the rocks. From what I hear, it nearly worked. Not so crude, then, if it almost killed him. Pardon, Torol, but almost is a big distinction in assassinations. True. Sadius searched within himself, seeking some sign of emotion at hearing that Elokar had almost died. He found none beside a faint sense of pity. He was fond of the boy, but to rebuild Alethkar, all vestiges of former rule would need to be removed. Elokar would need to die, preferably in a quiet manner, after Dalinar had been dealt with. Sadius expected he'd have to cut the boy's throat himself, out of respect for old Gavilar. "Who commissioned the assassins, do you suppose?" Sadius asked, speaking softly enough that, with the buffer his guards kept around their seats, he didn't have to worry about being overheard. "Hard to tell," ELA replied, scooting to the side and twisting to get him to scratch a different part of her back. "It wouldn't be Ruthar or Aladar." Both were solidly in Sadius's palm, Aladar with some resignation, Ruthar eagerly. Roian was too much a coward, others too careful. Who else could have done it? Thanadol, Sadius guessed. He's the most likely, but I will see what I can discover. It might be the same ones as with the king's armor, Sadius said. Perhaps we could find out more if I exercise my authority. Sadius was High Prince of Information, one of the old designations from previous centuries which split duties in the kingdom among high princes. It technically gave Sadius authority over investigations and policing. Perhaps, ELA said hesitantly. But... She shook her head, watching another exchange of the duelists down below. This bout of fighting left Adolin with stormlight streaming from one gauntlet to the booing of some of the dark eyes. Why were those people even allowed in? There were light eyes who were unable to attend because Elokar reserved seating for their inferiors. Dalinar, ELA said, has responded to our ploy of making you High Prince of Information. He used it as precedent for making himself High Prince of War, and so now every step you take invoking your rights as High Prince of Information cements his authority over this conflict. Sadius nodded. You have a plan, then? Not quite yet, ELA said. But I'm forming one. You've noticed how he started up patrols outside of the camps and in the outer market. Should that be your duty? No. That's the job of a High Prince of Commerce, which the king hasn't appointed. However, I should have authority over policing all 10 camps and appointing judges and magistrates. He should have involved me the moment an attempt was made on the king's life, but he didn't. Sadius chewed on the thought for a moment, removing his hand from Ile's back, letting her sit up straight. There is a weakness here we can exploit, Sadius said. Dalinar has always had a problem giving up authority. He never really trusts anyone to do their job. He didn't come to me when he should have. This weakens his claims that all parts of the kingdom should work together. It's a chink in his armor. Can you ram a dagger in it? ELA nodded. She'd use her informants to start questions in court. Why, if Dalinar was trying to forge a better Alethkar, was he unwilling to give up any power? Why hadn't he involved Satius in the king's protection? Why wouldn't he open his doors to Satius's judges? What authority did the throne have, really, if it made assignments like the one to Satius, only to pretend they hadn't been given? "You should renounce your appointment as High Prince of Information in protest," Ile said.
"No, not yet. We wait until the rumors have nipped at old Dalinar, made him decide he needs to let me do my job. Then, the moment before he tries to involve me, I renounce. It would widen the cracks that way, both in Dalinar and in the kingdom itself."
Adolin's bout continued below. He certainly didn't look like his heart was in it. He kept leaving himself open, taking hits. This was the youth who had bragged about his skill so often. He was good, of course, but not nearly that good. Not as good as Satius had himself seen when the boy had been on the battlefield fighting the... He was faking. Satius found himself grinning.
"Now that's almost clever," he said softly.
"What?" Ile asked.
"Adolin is fighting beneath his capacity," Satius explained, as the youth got a hit, barely, on Iraniv's helm. "He's reluctant to display his real skill, as he fears it will scare others away from dueling him. If he looks barely capable enough to win this fight, others might decide to pounce."
Ile narrowed her eyes, watching the fight.
"Are you sure? Couldn't he just be having an off day?"
"I'm sure," Satius said. Now that he knew what to watch for, he could easily read it in Adolin's specific moves, the way he teased Iraniv to attack him, then barely fended off the blows. Adolin Kolin was cleverer than Satius had given him credit for. Better at dueling, as well. It took skill to win a bout, but it took true mastery to win while making it look the whole time that you were behind. As the fight progressed, the crowd got into it, and Adolin made it a close contest. Satius doubted many others would see what he did. When Adolin, moving lethargically and leaking light from a dozen hits, all carefully allowed on different sections of plate, so none shattered and exposed him to real danger, managed to bring down Iraniv with a lucky blow at the end, the crowd roared in appreciation. Even the light eyes seemed drawn in. Iraniv stormed off, shouting about Adolin's luck, but Satius found himself quite impressed. "There might be a future for this boy," he thought. "More so than his father, at least."
"Another shard won," Ile said with dissatisfaction as Adolin raised a hand and walked off the field. "I'll redouble my efforts to make certain this doesn't happen again."
Satius tapped his finger against the side of his seat.
"What was it you said about duelists? That they're brash, hot-headed?"
"Yes, and?"
"Adolin is both of those things and more," Satius said softly, considering. "He can be goaded, pushed around, brought to anger. He has passion like his father, but he controls it less securely."
"Can I get him right up to the cliff's edge," Satius thought, "then shove him off?"
"Stop discouraging people from fighting him," Satius said. "Don't encourage them to fight him, either. Step back. I want to see how this develops."
"That sounds dangerous," Ile said. "That boy is a weapon, Toril."
"True," Satius said, standing. "But you are rarely cut by a weapon if you are the one holding its hilt."
He helped his wife to her feet.
"I also want you to tell Ruthar's wife that he can ride with me next time I decide to strike out on my own for a gem heart. Ruthar is eager. He can be of use to us."
She nodded, walking toward the exit. Satius followed, but hesitated, casting a glance toward Dalinar. How would this be if the man weren't trapped in the past? If he'd been willing to see the real world, rather than imagining it?
You'd probably have ended up killing him then, too, Sadius admitted to himself. Don't try to pretend otherwise. Best to be honest, at the very least, with oneself.
30. Nature blushing. 'Tis said it was warm in the land far away when void bringers entered our songs. We brought them home to stay, and then those homes became their own. It happened gradually, and years ahead 'twill still be said 'tis how it has to be. From the Listener Song of Histories, 12th stanza. Shallan gasped at the sudden flare of color. It disrupted the landscape like breaking lightning in an otherwise clear sky. Shallan set down her spheres. Tin was having her practice palming them, and stood up in the wagon, steadying herself with her free hand on the back of her seat. Yes, it was unmistakable, brilliant red and yellow on an otherwise dull canvas of brown and green. Tin, Shallan said, what's that? The other woman lounged with feet out, a wide-brimmed white hat tipped over her eyes, despite the fact that she was supposed to be driving. Shallan wore Bluth's hat, which she'd recovered from his things to keep the sun off. Tin turned to the side, lifting her hat. Huh? Right there, Shallan said. The color. Tin squinted. I don't see anything. How could she miss that color, so vibrant when compared to the rolling hills full of rock buds, reeds, and patches of grass? Shallan took the woman's spyglass and raised it to look more closely. Plants, Shallan said. There's a rock overhang there, sheltering them from the east. Oh, is that all? Tin settled back, closing her eyes. Thought it might be a caravan tent or something. Tin, it's plants. So? Divergent flora in an otherwise uniform ecosystem, Shallan exclaimed. We're going. I'll go tell Makub to steer the caravan that way. Kid, you're kind of strange, Tin said, as Shallan yelled at the other wagons to stop. Makub was reluctant to agree to the detour, but fortunately he accepted her authority. The caravan was about a day out from the shattered plains. They'd been taking it easy. Shallan struggled to contain her excitement. So much out here in the Frostlands was uniformly dull. Something new to draw was exciting beyond normal reason. They approached the ridge, which had caused a high shelf of rock at exactly the right angle to form a windbreak. Larger versions of these formations were called lakes, sheltered valleys where a town could flourish. Well, this wasn't nearly so large, but life had still found it. A grove of short, bone-white trees grew here. They had vivid red leaves. Vines of numerous varieties draped the rock wall itself, and the ground teemed with rock buds, a variety that remained open even when there wasn't rain, blossoms drooping with heavy petals from the inside, along with tongue-like tendrils that moved like worms, seeking water. A small pond reflected the blue sky, feeding the rock buds and trees. The leafy shade in turn gave shelter to a bright green moss. The beauty was like veins of ruby and emerald in a drab stone. Shallan hopped down the moment the wagons pulled up. She frightened something in the underbrush, and a few very small feral axe hounds burst away. She wasn't sure of the breed. She honestly wasn't even sure they were axe hounds, they moved so quickly. Well, she thought, walking into the tiny lake, that probably means I don't have to worry about anything larger. A predator like a white spine would have frightened away smaller life. Shallan walked forward with a smile. It was almost like a garden, though the plants were obviously wild rather than cultivated. They moved quickly to retract blooms, feelers, and leaves, opening a patch around her. She stifled a sneeze and pushed through to find a dark green pond.
Here she set down a blanket on a boulder, then settled herself to sketch. Others from the caravan went scouting through the late or around the top of the rock wall. Shallan breathed in the wonderful humidity as the plants relaxed, rockbud petals stretching out, timid leaves unfolding. Color swelled around her like nature blushing. Stormfather! She hadn't realized how much she'd missed the variety of beautiful plants. She opened her sketchbook and drew out a quick prayer in the name of Shalash, Herald of Beauty, Shallan's namesake. The plants retracted again as someone moved through them. Gaz stumbled past a group of rock buds, cursing as he tried not to step on their vines. He came up to her, then hesitated, looking down at the pool.
"Storms," he said. "Are those fish?"
"Eels," Shallan guessed, as something rippled the green surface of the pool. "Bright orange ones, it appears. We had some like them back in my father's ornamental garden." Gaz leaned down, trying to get a good look, until one of the eels broke the surface with a flipping tail, spraying him with water. Shallan laughed, taking a memory of the one-eyed man peering into those verdant depths, lips pursed, wiping his forehead. "What do you want, Gaz?"
"Well," he said, shuffling, "I was wondering..."
He glanced at the sketch pad. Shallan flipped to a new page in the pad. "Of course. Like the one I did for Glerv, I assume." Gaz coughed into his hand.
"Yeah, that one looked right nice."
Shallan smiled, then started sketching.
"You need me to pose or something?"
Gaz asked. "Sure," she said, mostly to keep him busy while she drew. She tidied up his uniform, smoothing out his paunch, taking liberties with his chin. Most of the difference, however, had to do with the expression, looking up into the distance. With the right expression, that eye patch became noble, that scarred face became wise, that uniform became a mark of pride. She filled it in with some light background details reminiscent of that night beside the fires, when the people of the caravan had thanked Gaz and the others for their rescue. She removed the sheet from the pad, then turned it toward him. Gaz took it reverently, running his hand through his hair.
"Storms," he whispered. "Is that really what I looked like?"
"Yes," Shallan said. She could faintly feel pattern as he vibrated softly nearby. A lie, but also a truth. That was certainly how the people Gaz saved had viewed him.
"Thank you, Brightness," Gaz said. "I thank you."
Ash's eyes. He actually seemed to be tearing up. "Keep it safe," Shallan said, "and don't fold it until tonight. I'll lacquer it so it won't smudge." He nodded and walked, frightening the plants again as he retreated. He was the sixth of the men to ask her for a likeness. She encouraged the requests. Anything to remind them of what they could and should be. "And you, Shallan," she thought. "Everyone seems to want you to be something. Yasna, Tin, your father. What do you want to be?" She flipped back through her sketchbook, finding the pages where she'd drawn herself in a half dozen different situations. A scholar, a woman of the court, an artist. Which did she want to be? Could she be them all? Pattern hummed. Shallan glanced to the side, noticing Vatha lurking in the trees nearby. The tall mercenary leader hadn't said anything of the sketches, but she saw his sneers. "Stop frightening my plants, Vatha," Shallan said.
"Makeup says we'll stop for the night," Vatha replied, then moved away.
"Trouble," Pattern buzzed.
"Yes, trouble."
"I know," Shallan said, waiting as the foliage returned, then sketching it. Unfortunately, though she'd been able to get charcoal and lacquer from the merchants, she didn't have any colored chalks, or she might have tried something more ambitious. Still,
This would be a nice series of studies, quite a change from the rest in this sketchbook. She pointedly did not think about what she had lost. She drew and drew, enjoying the simple peace of the small thicket. Lifespren joined her, the little green motes bobbing between leaves and blossoms. Pattern moved out onto the water and amusingly began quietly counting the leaves on a nearby tree. Shallan got a good half dozen drawings of the pond and trees, hoping she'd be able to identify those from a book later on. She made sure to do some close-up views showing the leaves in detail, then moved on to drawing whatever struck her. It was so nice to not be moving on a wagon while sketching. The environment here was just perfect. Sufficient light for drawing, still and serene, surrounded by life. She paused, noticing what she'd drawn. A rocky shore near the ocean, with distinctive cliffs rising behind. The perspective was distant. On the rocky shore, several shadowy figures helped one another out of the water. She swore one of them was Yalb. A hopeful fancy. She wished so much for them to be alive. She would probably never know. She turned the page and drew what came to her. A sketch of a woman kneeling over a body, raising a hammer and chisel as if to slam it down into the person's face. The one beneath her was stiff, wooden, maybe even stone. Shallan shook her head as she lowered her pencil and studied this drawing. Why had she drawn it? The first one made sense. She was worried about Yalb and the other sailors. But what did it say about her subconscious that she'd drawn this strange depiction? She looked up, realizing that shadows had grown long, the sun easing down to rest on the horizon. Shallan smiled at it, then jumped as she saw someone standing not 10 paces away. "Tin," Shallan said, raising her safe hand to her breast. "Stormfather, you gave me a fright." The woman picked her way through the foliage, which shied away from her. "Those drawings are nice, but I think you should spend more time practicing to forge signatures. You're a natural."